Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello there.
And today we decided we're going to talk a bit more about our Gen Con experience, dig a little bit more into some of the things we talked about at the What's Up with Onyx Path panel, and just really kind of, do a retrospective of our experience at the show. Next week we'll have another recorded panel, which will be our freelancing panel. But since we've covered some of that in the podcast, we figure it's more important to kind of talk about the show specifically before we do the freelancing panel one. So I guess we'll start. What did you guys think of the show?
I always have fun at Gen Con, but I mean, I'm a raging extrovert, so
raging,
obviously,
angry extrovert.
No, you know what I meant. Shut up. Mean.
I'm a frenzying extrovert.
Yes, I'm a frenzying
very
extrovert.
Very much embrace the zeitgeist of the time, as they like to say.
Yeah, I cannot help who I extrovert as, because I am in frenzy all the time. No, I had a great time. I always love talking to, fans. I like talking to people that maybe have never even heard of us before. I walked the show floor before it opened, because that's usually the best time that I have to walk the show floor.
Right.
Because, once the booth opens, we're kind of all there. But lots and lots of cool stuff this year. I really like seeing some of the more kind of fancy and extravagant booths people put up. Like Privateer Press always does a really cool booth.
Yeah.
There are other ones like scattered throughout where it looks like you're walking into like a castle or, through big wrought iron gates. And I'm like, this is nifty. So yeah, it's a fun show to attend once. Like, I would recommend it. Like, if you're into gaming, sometime go to Gen Con. Even if it's just one time, you should always go check it out.
Oh, definitely. It is the pinnacle, I guess, gaming experience in a way, at least from a retail perspective. There, you will never see more sellers selling board games, card games, miniatures games, and RPGs. And there's just such a huge range of companies there who are either demoing games that haven't been released yet, or they are previewing games that have just been funded on Kickstarter, or mm-hmm. they're selling games that are already widely available. And yeah, you get to experience games from, I guess, their concept stage all the way through to mass market stage, which is great fun, because when I was on my lunch break at one point, I just decided I would walk down one of the rows and stop off wherever there was a demo booth going, and just play a card game for 30 minutes or so, just to see what it was like.
Right.
And I got to play a fun little game called Mystic Veil, which is a simple deck building game, nice and easy. It certainly had a bit of a feel of Magic to it, but obviously it was a deck building game which was made up of lots of lovely transparent sleeves and nice artwork and etc. etc. But it's one of those things that a lot of people miss when they go to Gen Con. The people who just go for the retail experience are missing out on so many games they could be just experiencing by dropping in and dropping out. And that's one of my favorite things about the con.
Yeah, I have an update from a previous podcast. I've still never played a game at a convention.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Well, so we did talk a little bit about us and Matt McElroy, one of our other guys, our operations manager. We talked about, like, oh, if there's ever time, you can sit down and run a demo. And every time demos were going, the tables were full.
Yeah.
Or there were too many people in the booth to where I would have felt bad taking myself out of the booth even for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about it. I kind of, peered into some of the demos that were running in the booth, but I never got a chance to sit down and play. Oh, well.
Yeah,
I had great fun. I had great fun running. They came from beneath the sea. The groups who arrived to play that game were really on board with the, what's a good word? The mania, I guess. The WrestleMania, brother.
There we go.
Got that out of the way nice and early. First, 5 minutes? let me tell you something, Jack. I ran a short scenario for them by the name of Crabs! ! And the second group that I ran for did not interact with a single crab. And I guess this speaks to the way this game can go. But in their one, they decided they would set their game in rural Nebraska, which is known for its coastline. And so we had a lake with a trawler on it, inexplicably.
Right. Like,
yeah. And they decided to set their plot up around the fact that that trawler's never been on the lake before, and so they boated out there, and it was a trawler made up of sentient seaweed that was sort of encapsulating the entire area. It arrived from a sort of funnel, a sinkhole beneath the lake, mm-hmm. and was spooling out across Nebraska. And they had to take it down via many and sundry ways. But yeah, it was good fun in both cases.
I will say that at the panel and a couple times I watched you prepping the demos for They Came, and I've never seen people laugh so hard at rules explanations before in my life.
I told you, I've been editing that book and I laugh while I'm editing it. Like, that's not normal for RPG books, you know?
I know.
Like, I have been giggling to myself. Yeah, no, it's great. Like, I'll occasionally laugh a little bit over other things. There's some cute, you know, puns and stuff in, like, Pugmire and Monarchies. There's the occasional little joke that I get in other games. But with this one, it's just me, you know, like I said, giggling to myself the whole time. Like, this is not... hey, maybe don't write...
Oh, my microphone's on.
Awkward. Matthew Dawkins.
No.
I will turn this podcast around right now.
At least you didn't use your middle name yet.
That's true. It's always good fun to just do something as simple as explain the rules, explain how quips work, explain how cinematics work. As soon as you put into someone's mind that they can essentially deflect a killing blow coming towards them by using the kill the extra cinematic, as long as they're holding that extra when he or she dies and screaming no and naming him and, you know, swearing vengeance or justice, it puts the right kind of mood in players' minds and they're all prepared to do it. It just so happened that one of the groups I ran for decided to be actively homicidal, and yeah, they took kill the extra early on as it was one of the cards in the middle of the table. And they just used it to just choose an extra they didn't like and have him suffer a sudden cardiac arrest.
Oh, no!
There was no death coming to anyone. They just they thought Fishy Stan, that was his name, Fishy Stan, Salty Bob the Sailor didn't like Fishy Stan. And so they decided now would be a good time for Fishy Stan to die. And so they just used kill the extra, and so he just keeled over. Yeah. And yeah, so it's so all aqua puns all the time over here.
yeah.
So that's our Gen Con retrospective, in which Matthew just tells you about his games.
and it's interesting because we haven't really been demoing as a company in our booth for more than a year or two. I think it's only our second year doing it. So it's been interesting to kind of see the reaction, because a lot of people wanted to play up-and-coming games. You know, a lot of people were playing They Came, which is not yet. A lot of people wanted to play Geist Second Edition. Our friend Mike Hollywood, he ran into a bunch of Geist demos to get people really excited about that. There was some Scion demos. But also there were a couple here and there of demos of things like Pugmire, which is a game that was out and established. And I ran a lot of Pugmire, even though we had Monarchies of Mal on the horizon, even though we had announced Pirates of Pugmire, which we'll talk about a bit later. Even though Fetch Quest was, we had decks there and we were demoing it. I ran a couple games of Fetch Quest, but a lot of it was people who had never heard of Pugmire or who wanted to play specifically with me a game of Pugmire for an hour. So it was an interesting balance from my perspective, because you're right, Matthew, a lot of that is check out these games that are coming or check out these games that just funded on Kickstarter. A lot of the playing established games generally kind of goes towards our Wrecking Crew guys through the usual 4-hour Gen Con block, you know, event extravaganza thing, which I'm sure is a proper name, but now it's a Gen Con block extravaganza thing. But I mean, so in our booth demos, it was interesting to kind of have people come in and want to play. No, I just want to play this game because I'm really excited about this and I have an hour to play. It's like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed doing it. I ran for a bunch of different groups. And because I ran the same scenario multiple times, it's interesting to see how different groups handled the exact same elements Some groups were very aggressive. Some groups spent a lot of time role playing. Some groups just ran like crazy. It was a ton of fun to see people interact the same thing over and over and over again. So it's kind of an interesting perspective you don't get normally, from, at least for me.
I think I've unfortunately set a dangerous precedent for the lizards in Pugmire.
Oh no! what have you done?
Well, because I know Dixie loves hearing me talk about the games I'm running, not passive aggressive.
I started jealous, running because I never get to play any damn games.
I know. The thing is, I even ran Werewolf in the bar, well, the Forsaken, because I wanted to play test.
I heard about that, but I was invited.
No, you weren't. That was a deliberate omission.
My line. I'm in charge of that line, you know.
I know. I was worried that you'd really come down on me, you know, like a sort of J. Jonah Jameson character. You'd say, no, you know.
Dawkins!
strip these pure out of this book. We don't want those scum. We want it to be about ghost wolves all the time. Anyway, yeah, I started running that Pugmire scenario that we had on hand for Gen Con, and decided to just introduce a roving gecko into it, watching the party from the woods, and the party became so interested in this gecko wanderer that I had to start making up reasons for them being in the fearful forest, and there's rumors of threats of a lizard empire about to descend on the kingdom of Pugmire, and then it turned out that he'd lost a friend, a chameleon by the name of Slith, I think his name was. There was a hatch that was in the fearful forest that they all discovered. They all descended into. There was oil all over the place, and somehow, partway through that scenario, Pugmire had crossed over with Deviant, because the chameleon, a naturally curious lizard, had crawled in sort of an egg-shaped pod, and was examining all the blinking lights and control panels on the inside of it. And quite unintentionally sealed himself in, where it performed the fly-like transformation on him in some weird automative chameleon that oozed oil and lashed out at people with his tongue, naturally.
Wow.
And so they were running around an underground a bunker in the middle of the fearful forest trying to take out this deviant chameleon. So there you go, you can sell two games in one scenario.
So we actually in the adventure collection that I'm working on for Monarchies right now, one of the main characters, one of the adventures, is a lizard, and you get to learn a little bit about lizard society that I think we're working with Eddie to see if, you know, that's going to work for lizard society in the future. Nice. Something like that, but I think that's awesome. I'm a big fan of the chameleon turning into a terrifying creature.
Yeah, that is actually really, really cool. And actually, that's a nice segue into... We talk a bit more about some of the stuff we announced at Gen Con, because we had the panel, we recorded the panel, but each of those are kind of like little snippets, with a couple of exceptions. You guys did a pretty deep dive into what we're thinking about for Mummy. Matthew did a pretty deep dive into Chicago, which is going to be amazing. But there's some other projects that we didn't get a chance to really talk a ton about because we want to give time for questions. So this is kind of a nice segue into at least one of them, which is Pirates of Pugmire. I only gave kind of a brief breakdown of that. But one of the things in there is that I wanted to introduce in that book. It's a linked adventure book, but I wanted to have bits that go with those linked adventures. So it's exploration. There's going to be exploration stuff. There's going to be new... tricks and secrets for dogs and cats that want to explore and may have more callings or a remix of callings. I'm not sure about that piece yet. But there's going to be some new mechanical player character bits. But one of the big things about it is I do want to do lizards and birds as playable characters in that book.
Yay!
Because a lot of people have been asking about that. And initially I had plans to do three core books. I just don't think that's going to be sustainable. I think having dogs and cats as separate books does make sense. And Monarchies has a lot going on. But beyond that, each of the other species in Pugmire are either nomadic or are integrated into other societies. So giving them a complete book didn't quite make sense.
Well, if you do lizards and birds in this one, and then you have another one where you can introduce, like rodents and polecats, that makes total sense.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, because that'll give you all the uplifted races that we've already talked about, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually went to the zoo this weekend so I could do some research into lizards and birds and what kinds of cool things we do with them. To me, it's just amusing that I can do this stuff and say, this is research, it's totally valid. I mean,
Eddie, can I ask you
yes.
a burning question I have?
Yes.
How are you going to address a bird's hands? Because it's been bothering me so much. Because I'm like, they have wings and they don't have arms. They don't have like fingers. Like, cats and dogs have obvious like things that will turn into hands.
Right.
But birds don't, and it bothers me.
That's actually something I do need to kind of think through. And actually, I need to talk to Rich a little bit about it because one of the things that's really helped me with both Pugmire and Mao is to have him ask me art questions.
Okay, that is my art question because there is an
Right.
entire subreddit devoted to photoshopping big buff arms on birds, and that's all I think of when I imagine the Birds of Pugmire is the Birds of
See,
Arms subreddit.
I would go for some kind of, I know birds don't have shoulders, they don't have collarbones, but I would do some kind of over the wing like attachment, not necessarily like prehensile arms or anything, but I would imagine they'd do most of their things with their talons, their feet, and everything else would have to be pretty much maneuvered with their wings and with their head movements and so on. Which would mean each of them would come with their own sort of almost what would be like a war suit, which could be nice and fun, but I'm not the
Rubber.
developer. Yeah, exactly.
All right, y'all. That was the peek into what developing a game sounds like on
Yep,
the
absolutely. Yeah.
inside.
Oh, I mean, Matt, that's something else that I think is interesting when we do these kinds of Gen Con is that sometimes we announce stuff that's so early that people have questions like that, and I'm just like, I don't know, and I'm outlining it now. So, I mean, it's actually good to have these kinds of conversations, and Pirates of Pugmire is a good one to kind of have that conversation with now because we can get initial feedback from fans, what they like, what they don't like. I know Neil did something similar. We talked briefly about Demigod for Scion, but he's just kind of at the stage where he's got a lot of ideas, but he's kind of molding them and figuring out which direction he wants to take them. And so we had an internal conversation about Demigod. He talked a little bit at the panel about it. He talked to some people at the show about it. Again, kind of getting feedback from people who are excited and invested in it, who have burning questions about Scion arms, and can actually address those kinds of concerns and think about them as he's working on it. So it's interesting because, like, this show can be a way to kind of have your input into the development process, if even if perhaps as a fan you may not realize it's what you're doing.
Oh, totally. Like people ask me questions about things we're working on, and sometimes my even just my gut reaction to be like, absolutely not, or yes, definitely. I'm like, well, now I got to put that in there, but it definitely should be in there. So, okay, thanks. Thanks, fan.
Absolutely. So I know you the panel recorded your voice was breaking, Dixie. So we talked a lot about Mummy and you talked a bit about Exalted. Was there anything else on the Chronicles of Darkness or Exalted thing that you wanted to talk about a bit more now that you have your voice back and rested and everything?
I think Matthew went really well into what we were talking about for Mummy. I think what the only announcement we made for Mummy that we only made on the first panel, not the second one, which is the one we used for the podcast, is that we are introducing a way to play mummies of all races, genders, types of people. And it may not be what you think, but we are definitely introducing some mechanics to make that happen as well, so that you're not restricted in your character creation. But as far as the Timeless Chronicle and all that, I think Matthew covered it super well, and he was very clear on the recording because it was off his phone that was right in front of
Yes. Well,
us.
I come prepared. It is definitely worth stressing because I keep an eye on the Mummy the Curse sub forum on the Onyx Path forums,
Yeah.
and there's a bit of division. Some people would love to see Andean mummies and Chinese mummies and so on. Others are very much in favor of the Eremite or Nameless Empire mummies that, of course, were very much prevalent, well, the only protagonist in Mummy the Curse first edition. And your mummies are still going to have their origins in the Nameless Empire. That is still
Yes.
the origin point of the game.
Yeah,
Does that
they'll
mean
still
you?
all be Eremites on some level.
Exactly. Does that mean you can't play a South American mummy? Absolutely not. You can play one. You can play a Chinese mummy, but that's your host. That's your shell. Your origin will always be Irem, but you may not remember Irem. In fact, it's more likely than not that you won't. Because of the nature of the Timeless Chronicle, your first real memories of becoming an Arisen may well have been you waking up in Imperial China. And just imagine how that affects the way your mummy sees the world with successive awakenings. So yeah, I think second edition is going to open up a lot of doors for, to use some Chronicles of Darkness parlance, ha ha ha, for Mummy the Curse. I really hope so because it's a game I love and I really want it to do well.
It was the first
Right.
game you ever freelanced for, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was the first game I ever freelanced for paid. Dot dot dot.
Right.
But yeah, so I mean, aside from that, I've got I'm looking at some stuff for maybe some lines we haven't talked about as much recently. I've got some ideas kicking around for Demon the Descent. Deviant the Renegades is moving along, which is awesome. Matthew's been working on Shunned by the Moon for Forsaken. Yeah, Changeling is coming out soon. It needs to
Yep.
go through a couple more steps, but Changeling the Lost Second Edition should be shipping in the next, let's say, couple months or so, hopefully. I don't want to give a hard timeline on that because it does need to be indexed, which is a bit of a process, but it is just about done with the errata input. From what I've seen, which is awesome, because that was, I think, the Chronicles line I got asked about the most at the con.
Oh, really?
There's the, yeah, people were really excited, I think, because the Kickstarter was so recently. I mean, it wasn't super recently, but it was more recently. We're doing it last year and everything. So luckily, Megan Fitzgerald was in the booth, so there were lots of people that I could just be like, go talk to her. She's in charge of that. Go talk to that girl. But yeah, people are really excited about that. I know that Danielle has a couple of other things we're looking at for Requiem. So yeah, like Chronicles is just plugging along, doing its thing. Dark Eras 2 is in the works. That's exciting. We're in the Red Lines process for that right now. So that's been fun to watch because it's always fun to see how things change in Red Lines.
Absolutely.
And I think I made most of my Exalted announcements overall. Essentially, what I think anybody needs to know is that Eric and Vance are super gung ho. They are super awesome. The team is a well-oiled machine at this point, it seems like.
They have a 5-year plan.
Yeah, every time I turn around, they're like, here's four more pitches for Exalted. And I'm like, okay, can we finish these four books first? But I think it's really awesome that they're excited about it because that means that while they're, when you're developing, sometimes you have this like little bit of downtime when your writers are doing their final drafts or whatnot. And you have a little bit of downtime where you don't really have anything to do on that project. And so they spend that time sometimes working on pitches and outlines for more projects, which is great because it means we're getting things planned far in advance. But at some point, I kind of have to look at it and be like, okay, this thing that you just pitched is really like 2.5 years out. So we can put it through, but I don't want to forget about it either. So maybe hold on to it for a little bit. So I think after these that I just sent to approvals, we're probably going to hold off for a little bit on pitches so we get some more books rolling. But I would say look for the Lunar's Fangs at the Gate Kickstarter early next year. So hopefully in the next,
Yay.
5 to 7 months, I'd say. Which is very exciting.
Absolutely. And also shifting to World Darkness, but not going to the obvious one first. We did announce that you are going to be one of the developers for the upcoming Mage 20 book, Victorian Mage.
Yes, I'm working on an outline for that right now. I have an original outline. I'm doing a little bit of reworking on it, just to get a few points that I'd like to hit in it. I'm kind of a nerd about the Victorian era, and especially all over the world, the Victorian era, not just England.
Right.
So I'm making sure that some of that goes into the book as well, because I mean, when a lot of people, like I said, think about the Victorian era, they don't think about the Civil War or the Crimean War, but those happened during that. And there were tons of other small conflicts and things throughout the world. I mean, it spans nearly 100 years of global history, and it's 100 years of rapid progress because you're coming right up on the 20th century all the way through it. So there's a lot of really cool stuff happening. And with Mage, that also means that you have things like the Order of Reason kind of shifting to the Technocracy. There's all kinds of interesting things going on in the Mage universe. I do have a co-developer on that who I'm not announcing yet just because I haven't had him sign a contract yet. But I think it's a very exciting co-developer, and I'm looking forward to it. And of course, for anyone who's nervous, Stilbrucato is still involved. He's still writing on it. He's still consulting on it. So he's still getting approval on everything. So don't think that I'm like taking Phil's vision and, completely throwing it in the garbage. Like, obviously, right. We really love Phil's vision from age 20. Like, Phil Brucato kind of is Mage 20. So definitely, like, have him on the project still before anybody gets nervous and goes, you know, who's this girl taking over Phil's project? No, I'm not. I promise. Phil is still there.
We would have... Oh, sorry. Oh, look at that. All three of us talking at the same time. That very rarely happens.
This is like
a nexus convergence. But no, I was going to say that... We could never excise Phil. We'd never want to. Every one of the Mage books is like a different organ of Phil's body. Well, God, that's a weird thought, isn't it?
Are those his take Phil's essence and put it into somebody else if we implant them with books?
We could bottle Phil.
Oh.
Yeah. Essence of Phil. Essence of Satyr. In fact, I think Essence of Satyr is an artifact, is a treasure in Changeling the Dreaming. So... there you go, because I think I wrote it for Changeling the Dreaming.
Oh my god.
It only makes you smell good if you are, of course, a satyr already. Otherwise you're gonna smell like Randy Goat. But that isn't a man who lives down the road, by the way.
Randy M. Goat, yeah.
But
gone in Esquire. A direction.
Yeah, anyway, I'm very much looking forward to where Victorian Mage goes, and Phil is still going to be developing Technocracy Reloaded.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Really, that's one of the reasons I've wanted to divide up Phil's duties to get him on as a consultant on Victorian. There's a few big Mage books coming up, and for anyone, no matter how experienced in this industry, it can be a real killer to your creativity to have a few massive projects bearing down at you at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's all very well to have him spread his talents around different books, but if he's performing the same role on all three of those books, that's a big ask for anybody.
Yeah.
So Phil's perfectly happy with this. He proposed the role of consultant, and we are more than happy to have him in that role. And I've got all faith in Dixie, no pressure, Dixie, to deliver a brilliant book on the Victorian era. And of course, it's a subject of great national pride that the rest of the world still calls the 19th century the Victorian era. Given, you know, again, like you say, the Civil War, Garibaldi's Revolution, all of that.
Yeah, there were a lot of things that happened during that time, right. But Victoria was there the whole time.
One of the things that I remember we chatted about briefly, Dixie, at Gen Con, I think Magic Men in the first panel, was the fact that Zane Grey is just as legitimately Victorian literature as, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle or you know, Dickens or whatever, because it was contemporaneous.
Yeah, the Wild West was during the Victorian era. Like what the period everybody thinks of as the Wild West was during the Victorian era, and it's and I mean, I know that we're just talking about North America right now, but even just in the U.S. there was so much happening during that period.
Yeah.
And so if you take the fact that was just in the U.S. because like Zane Grey and Dickens are contemporaries on some level, but then you also look at the fact that there are, you know, six other continents that aren't even just North America, where there was tons of stuff going on. I'm really excited to kind of talk a little bit about, you know, various kind of, like, countries in Asia, various civilizations throughout Africa, South America, you know, what was going on in Russia at the time. Like, let's, you know, kind of make it a global book. And especially since mages can travel fairly easily throughout places. I know that the original concept for some of the chapters was that of like a travelogue.
Right.
And so I'm hoping to continue that, but have the travelogues be from different perspectives of different people from different cultures. It
so
will
not
mean
like
that writing
Beckett's Jihad Diary, in the sense that there's one narrator through the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. If we can do, like, you know, series of letters home or travelogues or something of that nature, because travelogues were incredibly popular forms of literature in the Victorian era.
Well, sure, Dracula was basically that.
Yeah, pretty much. Doing a little bit of that, having folks from different cultures. Much like with Chicago by Night and a few of our other books, I am trying to bring on a pretty diverse writing team.
Mm-hmm.
And this will be a book that requires a decent amount of research just to make sure we get it right. So that's all the stuff that I'm kind of super concerned about. Not concerned as in I'm worried about it already, just that I'm trying to make sure I keep an eye on it. But
you're thinking about.
Yeah. Yes, very much so. Because a lot of the Victorian era narratives that we have are from a colonialist perspective. And that is not the perspective of the majority of the world during that time. That's mostly the perspective of the Bloody Brits, Matthew Dawkins, and various Americans and things. So I'm excited to kind of look at some other perspectives and shift them around and take the Victorian era a little bit more global than the, you know, corsets and tea and whatever everybody thinks of. So.
And actually, that's almost a good segue, because you had a segue and then we jumped past it, but slipping.
Yeah, I said Chicago by Night. I was like, let's just scoot over there.
Right, exactly. And then I screwed up because I'm refreshing. But yeah, I mean, let's talk about, I mean, we talked a lot about Chicago by Night and the panel, but I mean, I'd like to kind of broaden that out a bit. Matthew, you're probably the best person to recognize this. How was the reaction to V5 at the show?
Oh, well, the reaction to V5 was insanely positive. And I guess that there was a fear, let's be honest, there was a fear that it wouldn't be. That's always going to be the case with a new edition of a game, especially a game as big as Vampire the Masquerade,
right?
That the fans will turn on it, or people just won't buy it because they're happy with their current edition or a previous edition or what have you. And quite the contrary, I know for a fact White Wolf, had they not restocked from Modiphius during the course of the convention, would have run out of books, I think, on Saturday morning.
I think so.
They had run through half their booth's stock on Thursday, so the first day of the con.
They had, like, boxes and boxes and boxes.
That was the only book they had at their booth, and they were running out.
Yep, I don't know exact figures, but I believe it's over 1,000 copies sold at Gen Con, which is pretty good, all told. Pretty good being an understatement. The whole White Wolf team was there. I think pretty much the whole White Wolf team was there. And, of course, I was happy Mr. Little Tag-Along who appeared at their panel. But I was with Onyx Path at the con, occasionally poking my head into White Wolf affairs. But the fact that, speaking from a pure, I guess, marketing perspective, it was very valuable for us, Onyx Path, to have White Wolf just across the aisle from us, because people would buy V5 and then they would be directed by White Wolf, hey, have you checked out Beckett's Jihad Diary over on the Onyx Path booth? And so they'd walk over to the aisle, ask about that, and they might pick that up as well, or vice versa.
Yeah,
there was a lovely amount of, I guess, synchronicity, a lot of work, very close working together. And that doesn't always come easy between different companies, and especially when your company's playing in the same playground. But we worked together incredibly well this Gen Con, and that was a delight.
Yeah, absolutely it was.
Yeah, no, I was really happy because there were a lot of people that would come up and kind of go like, well, how is, like, even our booth, and go, well, how is V5 different from V20, or what's changed, or whatever, and I would just kind of slide Beckett's at them and be like, here you go. This is your intro. This is the bridge book.
Yeah.
So I think that was an incredibly helpful tool. Also, that book is just beautiful. So having an open copy we could hand to people and say, like, hey, look through this, was really, really cool.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me because I can't think of many editions that have that kind of explicit handshake between them like we did with Beckett's.
Yeah.
No, I think you're right. That's that is an interesting perspective, because I'm trying to think of books in D&D that may have done that, and I can only think of one that went between second edition and third edition. That was an adventure called Ruins of Mithranor. I think that one started introducing some third edition rules or some third edition settings, but that's about it. And so, yeah, I think that's an interesting point. The we did very well with Beckett's, undoubtedly. There were a lot of people asking about it. Some people came up to me and said, so how much of this is going to make its way into V5? Because they could see Beckett's, and Beckett's is, by page count, I believe, a bigger book than V5. So yeah. Quite rightly, they were saying, well, this is one big book of setting. How much of this is going to get covered in V5? And I have to say, not all of it. But that's partly because Beckett's leaves a hell of a lot of room for storyteller expansion. There's a lot of open, dangling plot threads that are deliberately left that way for your chronicles. And sometimes there's completely contrary plot points in there. So mm-hmm. at the end of one chapter, it might say, one paragraph up, it will say the Setites are attempting to cash in their invitation to join the Camarilla. And then another paragraph down, the plot hook is the Setites have decided to go even more fervently independent, or words to that effect. I don't think we say that in the book, but point being, it's a book with a lot of options. And I think there's going to be some fans who have a favorite Chronicle hook that's in Beckett's that isn't immediately touched upon in V5. But to them, I would say, please be patient. Don't worry. There are going to be many more V5 books yet. And I would be surprised if Beckett's isn't used as a resource to build on lots of elements of meta plot to come, because White Wolf love it. We're obviously very proud of it on Onyx Path, mm-hmm. and the fans seem to love it as well.
Well, I know that explicitly happened because we kind of glossed over it at the show, but I was one of the writers for V5 Chicago, and one of the characters I picked was Critias, the Bruja Primogen, and he's explicitly name-dropped and has a mechanical or a plot bit in Beckett's that I pulled that thread and used in the V5 Chicago book. So there's explicitly I referenced that book to add new material to V5 Chicago by Night.
Yeah, we've got quite a lot. I'm currently midway through Red Lines on Chicago, almost exactly midway through. I've been doing them today prior to recording. And a lot of the writers have picked up and ran with little bits of Beckett's Jihad Diary that won't require you to buy the book in order to understand it. But it's like all Easter eggs. It's something you will appreciate more if you've seen the full picture, but it isn't going to disrupt your play if you haven't seen the full picture, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, Chicago by Night, as one thing I went into a great deal on the panel was, and I did this on the White Wolf panel as well, was our desire for diversity in our writing team and in our cast of characters, because it's one of those funny things. White Wolf of old, very much known as a left-wing progressive company in a sea of companies that weren't necessarily as much so, probably because it was comprised of very young people, you know, with very outlandish views and counterculture ideals and so on. And yet, Chicago by Night still has a strongly Midwest feel, the original one, because there's only a handful of black characters in a book set in Chicago, which is one of the most ethnically diverse cities in America.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's one of those things you can easily amend yourself as a storyteller, but it's something we didn't want to have to make you amend in this edition. So there is going to be representation across a broad spectrum of personalities in Chicago 5th edition, but by no means is that the only selling point. As I've mentioned many times, this is the book that's going to have Clan La Sombra in, which is something I know pleases Dixie a great deal.
Yay!
As our resident keeper. Or are you more a magister? What sect do you drift toward?
I'm probably more of a magister when it comes right down to it. But I just like La Sombra in general. I mean, when I started playing many years ago, it was very like, you know, they're cool. They have shadows and they use their shadows to kill people and that's fun. But then I started getting like more into the lore over time. But really just what drew me to them in the beginning was that they always kind of said, like, you know, social Darwinists, elegant predator kind of thing. And they seemed for a long time to me as like the kind of one of the more traditional, in air quotes, vampires.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started playing and I started kind of being like, you know, okay, I'm going to play this character, it's going to be fun, I definitely just kind of went to them as one of the most familiar kinds of vampire. You know, they cast their reflection, they are, you know, kind of dominating, they think they're kind of superior. There's still a lot of religion in their clan, which I know a lot of vampires don't have, but a lot of vampire lore is very tied to various religion things.
Sure.
Yes. So there are a lot of just little bits that drew me to them. So I'm not sure if I really care too much about a particular sect or not. I just like the clan as a whole, and I am very excited with the direction they're going in V5.
And actually, one of the things that we talked about in one of our pre-shows that we didn't record, but I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to kind of work this in so everyone can hear it, is the fact that the Little Sombra have had various interpretations throughout the editions. It's only been until about revised, late revised, early B20, depending on how you slice it, where the Little Sombra had kind of more of a codified approach and aesthetic.
Yeah. If anything, I would say Dark Ages has had more of an impact on the way most people see La Sombra than Masquerade.
You're a good point.
And it's probably, yeah, it's that religious element for me anyway. But again, this is an interesting thing because for me, it's the strongly ecclesiastical element. For Dixie, it might be the social Darwinist element. And other people are going to see them as the rambunctious Sabbat pack who are depicted on the first edition La Sombra, the first La Sombra clan book, you know, a punk sticking his tongue out with a black hand tattoo slapped on his bald forehead.
Yeah, yep. And I seriously almost always forget about that guy, just go straight to Lucita.
yeah, exactly. It's a clan that's had, I guess, a troubled upbringing, not as troubled as some clans in Vampire the Masquerade.
Mm-hmm.
But for that reason, it's very interesting to me to see us depict them in V5. And one thing I'll say, actually, because there's been quite a lot of buzz about this on Facebook, both good and bad, and I'll address it, is some people are unhappy that Clan La Sombra is being introduced in what they're calling a sourcebook about a city they may never use. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually fair. They may never play a game in Chicago.
Yeah, absolutely.
But although it's called Chicago by Night, and although we are going to certainly be touching on Chicago meta plots and some characters from previous editions, it's also more broadly going to be the city source book. You know, this is going to be the book you use to I guess, template the cities you use in your games.
Right.
It's not going to be impossible. In fact, it's going to be pretty easy to transplant a lot of the features that we're introducing in Chicago by Night for V5 into London or Paris or New York or wherever you happen to be situated.
And it's also a huge book of NPCs if you want to use them, regardless of what city they're in.
Exactly. There's going to be so much in this book. It's quite absurd. And it's not isn't a random mishmash. We have in-character lore documents. So much as they were popular in Beckett's Jihad Diary, I can't get rid of the damn things. You'll have plenty of transcripts, emails, and text messages and things that you can hand out as artifacts at the table. There'll be plenty of lore sheets, which have proven immensely popular for V5.
Yeah, lore sheets are great.
And for anyone unfamiliar, those are essentially like backgrounds or merits that tie you specifically into arenas, parts of the meta plot. So you could be a descendant of Hardstadt as a lore sheet, and that gives you more benefits than just having Hardstadt as a mentor. At two dots, it might mean you've got a direct line to Hardstadt, and you can ask him one question in a chronicle if he chooses to pick up. I think, you know, it's fun little things like that. So we've got lore sheets, we've got more coterie design mechanisms, ways to basically encourage troop play, and it's been really fun. You've probably both seen two of our friends, you mentioned one of them already, Eddie, Mike Hollywood and Meredith, big Gerber. Friends of the company,
mm-hmm.
And Mike freelances for us. And they have just started a V5 Chronicle and have already started making a big coterie map, a big relationship chart for their characters. And it's wonderful mm-hmm. to see in the flesh. It's brilliant.
Yeah, no, it was really, really cool. It was a good idea to begin with, but then seeing them actually put it into use, I'm like, I want to run V5 now. I want to make a coterie map. It sounds awesome.
Yeah, that made me think, I need to stop writing this and start playing it a little more. but yeah, in short, there's going to be a lot to use in this book. It isn't just the La Sombra book. It isn't just the Chicago book. It's going to be a whole grab bag of things like I try and make all of my books so that a storyteller can go into it and find at least one thing that they want to use, but hopefully a lot more.
Absolutely. And another license partner that we kind of announced earlier, but we definitely announced at Gen Con, was Extra Time Media to announce our Dystopia Rising Evolution tabletop game. Actually shared a booth with them, which was actually a lot of fun. I mean, last year we shared a booth with White Wolf. This year we shared a booth with Eschaton Media, Imagination Nation. And it was just nice to have different people in the booth. It's different dynamic. Different fans are coming by to check them out as well as us. But that's one of the games I'm working on. And again, we didn't talk much about this on the panel. It's a post-apocalyptic game. It's kind of Mad Max meets The Walking Dead, so you're fighting zombies, but it's more explicitly post-apocalyptic than, like, say, Walking Dead, where it's like 5 minutes after everything goes bad. This is more like several generations. And it was really, really interesting because this is another potentially controversial game in the sense that it's a game that's based off of an established 10 years of franchise history, of strong live-action community. It's very possible that fans may not gravitate well to it, or they may have strong opinions about it. And I was very relieved when I ran a session on Friday for the people who run the Dystopia Rising booth, so they can get a sense of it, and they loved it. And then I saw them running it for other Dystopia Rising fans, and they all really liked it. They felt it was very true to the material. We have done some updates to it, so the material is from a canonical perspective, it's like roughly 10 years in the future. But also it was a chance to kind of soft reboot some elements, just tweak a few things here and there, things that we've learned from game design over time that Imagination Nation decided they wanted to kind of modernize and update, or just change some things so they have more sustainability when they were expecting to run for 10 years. When first, like, oh, we'll make a game and see what happens. Now it's like, well, we're 10 years in. Now we have to build out some infrastructure, as it were, so we, you know, we can make more character-type concepts. We can uplift a couple things so that they're a little less seedy, give players more options to move around, because they're all things that weren't necessarily thought of originally. And then, so it's been really exciting to work with that, and also because it's a story path game, to kind of take that in a different direction. It's from a design perspective, it's weird because we started with Storyteller, which was for action horror, is kind of where I think the initial World Darkness games landed, and they got creepier and darker, sometimes more action oriented depending on the edition, but they started there, moved around through Chronicles of Darkness storytelling, and then we got StoryPath. It was specifically designed to be very scalable, high action for Scion and Trinity. And so to bring it back down to kind of where it all started has been interesting because it's still a very different game than classic Storyteller system.
Right.
And one of the things that was an interesting balance is you have a very strongly narrative design, but you have to work resource management into that. And that was something that I was really worried about, because that's a big piece of Dystopia Rising as a franchise is, okay, I've got five meals, but I have eight people in my party that are hungry. So who's going to eat and who's not? Those kinds of choices are very iconic to both the post-apocalyptic genre, but also to Dystopia Rising specifically. And so I was worried about that piece, but again, I ran it and everyone seemed to really dig the idea that this is all based off of conditions and resolving conditions and having more conditions than ability to resolve them. So you're always like slightly behind. There's always something going slightly wrong. And people kind of got to that and gravitated to that. So then the quote unquote resource management is more, okay, which problem do I solve rather than, okay, I'm solving them all and now I'm done. That never quite get there. And by the time this airs, either the Kickstarter will have launched or is about to be launched. So it's very, very soon. And so right now I'm deep in the weeds in figuring that out. But again, it was interesting to kind of go to Gen Con, and previously when we first announced it at Midwinter, to be able to talk to people who are deeply invested in this franchise and get their thoughts and inputs and help that kind of shape and direct things in much the same way like we talked about with Vampire the Masquerade or with Mage or everything else, with Pugmire even, to be able to say, okay, but what if it had this and what if it had that? And those are really sometimes good conversations to have that you can't always have through, like, say, Twitter or Facebook or the forums, because it's just different tone, different approach to things. But having one-on-one conversations with people who are really invested and are very, very intelligent can sometimes unlock things, go, aha, that makes perfect sense. Let me go ahead and do that piece now. So that was very exciting. And also, for me at least, it was nice to kind of get back into the slightly darker stuff. I love Pugmire. I will love Pugmire forever. But sometimes it's nice to kind of get your hands dirty and to play with more controversial material. And that's why it's been fun to get back into working on Chicago. And also worked on another project with Matthew unrelated to Oxpath. I don't think it's been announced yet. But just getting into that darker stuff's been really exciting for me creatively because it's nice to kind of bounce around and try new things. So
Yeah, we
getting
do
closer to
love our
time.
horror.
We do love our horror, and I think we always kind of have a piece of that in our core. But we're getting close to time. I got about 10 minutes left. So, is there anything else that you guys great experiences you had at Gen Con? Things that you want everyone to know? Dixie, anything else that you want to talk about?
I had five shrimp cocktails at Harry and Izzy's.
So we should talk
In
about
a
the Harry and
row, in a
Izzy's.
row, one night.
No, over the course of 5 days. But I had pretty much one a day. So I'm going to talk about this because it's
You
actually
should
super important to
absolutely.
me.
It's a staple.
There is a shrimp cocktail at Harry and Izzy's in Indy called the St. Elmo Shrimp Cocktail, where they pretty much seems like they grate an entire horseradish root and then just throw a little bit of red sauce on top of that and call it cocktail sauce. Even eating it very slowly and in small bites, you tear up and your sinuses are clear for the next 5 years, and
Yes.
your head gets hot. And I am apparently a masochist because I had five. I went out one of the
Well,
last nights with you, Matthew, and Dave Brickshaw, Megan Fitzgerald, and Neil Price. And Neil actually ate a whole shrimp on his first bite, and then we were actively worried he was dying for a
Yeah,
minute.
he did he did go rather red in the face, more so than usual.
I feel bad, but that was really
Poor
funny.
Neil.
So yeah, that was what I want to talk about regarding Gen Con with shrimp
Well,
cocktails.
what
I think
I
I'm more than
find with that,
Rich.
because I almost, yeah, I imagine, yeah, because Rich left on the Saturday, of course. So yeah, unless he was sneaking shrimp cocktails in, but I've bought the sauce before because you can buy it from the restaurant,
Oh, you can.
Yeah.
bottled and bring it back. It's never the same at home, and I think it's something to do with temperature. I
Well,
think
even the Harry and Izzy's in the airport, it's not as strong as it is at the
no.
Harry and Izzy's downtown, because I had two in the airport and three at the downtown location. And yeah, not as strong at the airport.
Well, I've got a story.
Go for it.
This is my sort of boys can wear Wonder Woman t-shirt story. So when I was at the Onyx Path booth, I was speaking to a prospective freelance writer, a lovely chap who was there with his father, and they were both asking lots of questions about the kinds of people we want to hire, the kinds of process you need to go through in order to get hired, the submission process, all of that. And one of them asked me about I guess hiring diversely. And I guess I got a little onto my pulpit when it came to this, because it's part of the industry that very much requires improvement. And there'll be people that criticize talk like that as tokenism or trying to hit quotas, but that's not true. I think that any industry to be healthy, to be profitable, speaking purely pragmatically, is going to do better if it's represented diversely.
I agree.
And you can look at the Assassin's Creed games where you can get to play a female character. In fact, you mentioned this in one of the previous podcasts,
I
Dixie,
did.
about playing Mass Effect and being able to play a female Shepard. Is that's a big thing, and it shouldn't be a big thing because it should be natural, but it is a big thing because it so far hasn't been natural in the industry. And the thing I've observed is that white guys like me and Eddie, we will quite happily play a male character, a female character, a black protagonist, or what have you, because we've already had our cake and eaten it.
Well,
We have been served,
also
but
for,
that.
sorry, I was just gonna say, for a long time too, when they made female protagonists in games, like looking at you, Tomb Raider, they were making them for the male gaze. They weren't making them so that I could feel empowered. It's only recently that they've changed that for things like Tomb Raider. And even that, like, a lot of dudes on the internet were pissed off that her boobs were smaller. So, anyway, that's my two cents on that. So, go ahead.
But, well, I guess I got onto the subject that, you know, there's something aspirational about having more female developers, having more developers and writers who are people of color, having different groups represented among our crew, whether it's Onyx Path or any other company I'm working at. And again, you can take the idealistic approach, which isn't wrong, and say that it's a morally good thing to display that you're diverse, you're open to new ideas, new cultures, and so on. But again, pragmatically, business sense, it is also a very good thing to be diverse, because you stand the potential then of reaching a wider audience. Yeah. And that's why on books like Chicago, and like you're going to be doing on Victorian, and like we've done on many books past and will do in the future, it behooves us to hire a diverse crowd, which will include white people, it will include black people, it will include women, it will include everyone we can reach out to, because sometimes there are concepts, there's cultures, there's backgrounds that we, representing our group, cannot write about with as much authenticity as someone who has lived it. Mm-hmm. And to go back to Chicago by Night, my mentioning it's an incredibly diverse city, Chicago, that warrants having an incredibly diverse crew of writers, because you're never going to truly evoke the feel of Chicago, a city I've been to plenty of times because I love Chicago, but I'm a tourist when I go there. I couldn't write the whole book without it looking like the Time Out Guide to Chicago, because all I know is what the tourist sees. So that's why I'm hiring people from Chicago to write about it, especially people who are from a variety of backgrounds. And this isn't me trying to, I promise, this isn't me trying to appear as a saint or anything like that. But it was a moment where I guess I started really going off on one in the booth. But these people were genuinely interested. They were really happy that Onyx Path has a commitment to hiring in such diverse ways. And it made my day to be able to explain that to someone and for them to be receptive to it, for them to be really enthused about the fact that we are trying to get a authentic feel for our games and original voices.
Just in case it makes you feel like self-aggrandizing or something, to tell the very end of the story, do you mind if I tell it? Because the very end of this is what I like. I was watching this conversation happen.
I wasn't actually going to mention the end of the story, because I was going to end it there because I was worried it would make me sound incredibly arrogant.
I was maybe 10 feet away when this was happening, so I saw this happen. It was really cool. So Matthew's sitting there talking to this, you know, father and son, not realizing the whole time he's going on and on about the import diversity and whatever, that there was a young black gentleman standing behind him perusing books, which I thought was really cool, because that gentleman got to hear him very genuinely say these things without it looking like he was saying it for the benefit of an audience.
Right.
And it was actually kind of funny, because while he was having this conversation, I was over at the podium we set up having a similar conversation about diversity and Exalted. And neither of us knew this was happening. It is something that we are passionate about. It's including all genders, all sexualities, all races, representation across the board as much as we can. Of course, there's some folks I have harder trouble finding than others. But yeah, that to me is what really makes that story the most awesome, is that, you know, folks do get to kind of hear that we do care about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying, like Matthew said, I'm not trying to be like White Knight, toot my own horn and say, look how perfect we are, because we still screw up. Like, no one's perfect.
No,
but
we made mistakes.
We try. And please call, like, me out if I ever do anything stupid or wrong. Like, I would rather be called out and said, like, hey, this is really insensitive what you just said. Or, hey, I realized that 90% of your staff on this thing is white men. Like, oh, okay, well, thank you for pointing that out, because I was just hiring the people that we hire, you know? So,
And to kind of flip it around, actually, that weirdly does lead into one of my moments, is that I had the reverse situation where I two or three different people came up to me and said, listen, we would like to be more inclusive of disability in our products. Can I ask you some questions about some ideas off of you? Because, and so it ended up being some very good conversations about, I won't speak for all disabled people, but certainly for my own disability of hearing loss, I spoke a lot about this is why this stuff, I feel included or I don't feel included.
Right.
It's a very tricky thing because disability advocacy and inclusion is not the same as a gender or race inclusion. Each one is its own set of problems. You can't just be generically diverse. And the fact that a few different people did want to sit down with me and talk to me about it, and also I did talk with people with other disabilities, and we had some great conversations about educating me more so I can work that into my ongoing conversations with people. We noticed that there was some troubled spots with Gen Con in terms of how accessible they were for disabled people. That's something that, you know, we can work together and say, okay, well, maybe we can help them as a show get better about these kinds of things, to give them advice and suggestions and consult for them. It was really exciting to me to see, like you guys said, we try not to toot our own horn. So to kind of shift it and say other people in the industry are also interested in this, are also trying to do better about this.
Yes.
And to see friends of the company like Chris Bivey and Darker Hue Studios to get some great awards and to show that, you know, something is tipping and diversity is becoming more of something that people are interested in and excited about. And to have an established show like Gen Con to also celebrate that is huge and something that, you know, it's great to see.
I definitely wish that I could remember exactly what Eloy LaSanta and Chris Bivey said when they were receiving their Annies, because they had some really fantastic words. But the live stream of the Annies is on YouTube now, if anybody wants to watch it.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, you can just skip around to parts that you care about, whatever. But I know that both Eloy and Chris had some really nice words. And honestly, seeing the diversity on stage there that night, like, granted, it's still majority, I'd say, white guys overall, but there were a ton of women on stage, which was awesome. One of my trans friends won an award, which was really cool. And then there was, you know, more than one or two people of color, which was nice too. So yeah, mm-hmm. And it was a really, really good ceremony as far as inclusivity goes. And I hope it gets better, because even that I was like, well, you know, this is great, but it could be better. I'm hoping that we actually get to have Chris on the podcast sometime soon, because he's been doing some really cool stuff recently. And also, every time I turn around, I feel like he makes some announcement about Harlem Unbound being used as a college text or being put in the Smithsonian. And I'm like, geez, what? Like, this is just beyond, I think, his wildest dream so far.
To be fair, and this is a good way to kind of wrap things up. A lot of people did reach out to us separately and together about wanting to be on the Pathcast. And I mean, we definitely want to explore to get more people to talk about people, because it allows us to not only talk about games we love both working on and playing, but also a chance to kind of just talk more about the industry and get more ideas out there. So, I mean, you know, the fact that people are excited about the Pathcast and want to be on it is really heartening.
Yeah, future guests you're going to start seeing, hearing more people from other companies, I think. We're still going to, you know, try to work our way through our pool of freelancers and writers and devs and everything, just because I know people want to hear these kind of deep dives into our projects. Mm-hmm. But also, I think we're going to be pulling to people that maybe work with us a little bit or peripherally, but work for different companies. Maybe some of the folks from White Wolf, maybe folks like Chris Bivey, who is, you know, a writer on Chicago by Night, but he has a ton of his own projects that we will totally
Steve Kenson's
talk about. Steve Kenson's
another example of
working
on a lot of projects. He's working for us on Aberrant. Yeah.
Yeah. So, speaking of diversifying, we're going to diversify our guest list in the future. For the first few weeks here, we did concentrate mostly on kind of our employees. And we're still going to have a few of us, you know, on here and there, because we've got so many folks we could go through.
Absolutely.
But we're definitely going to try to get a few other voices in here, you know, off and on, depending on who we can grab. So if there's anybody that you would like to hear from, especially someone that has worked at least on some level with Onyx Path, past or present, feel free to put that in the comments so we can see who we can reach out to.
Speaking of diversifying, I was going to say I quit, find a new host, but I don't really. let's diversify our terrible trio. But no, we're locked in for life now.
Oh, gosh.
Right, anyway, sorry, carry on, Eddie.
So they can find me.
See, I
on...
had a segue, and then Matthew comes in and just ruins it. Maybe we will diversify. Maybe we'll reconsider our construction now and then.
Matthew, in Sailor Moon terms, I think Matthew is the tuxedo mask of this podcast, where he always comes in and acts like he's saving everybody, but really he doesn't do a whole lot except throw a smoke bomb and tell Sailor Moon to quit crying.
Well, I'm like Zoom. Not Professor Zoom, but Zoom, the Wally West Flash villain. So I screw things up to make the heroes better. You know, you're only going to become a true hero if you're faced with a true villain. And so that's me, I'm afraid.
Well, before we completely devolve into nothing but pop culture references, Dixie, how will people find you online?
I'm on most social media as at Dixie Cyanide. Twitter works. I'm sometimes slow at responding just because I don't always get notifications for some reason. But Twitter works. I'm on Facebook, but my friends list is already really bloated. Onyx Path forums, etc. That is where I'm at. Matthew?
You can find me on the Onyx Path forums as The Gentleman Gamer. You can find me on Twitter as Clack Click Bang. You can find me on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer. And if you've not already done so, you can look up The Gentleman's Guide to Vampires, which has restarted again on White Wolf's official channel to guide you through the various, I guess, fundaments of Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition.
And as always, you can find me just about any social media website at Eddie Fate, EDYFATE.com. You can also find me at Pugsteady. And you can also find me at those websites, EddieFate.com, Pugsteady.com. And as always, many worlds, one path.
Come, come, Mr. Bond. You and I both know that you enjoy murder just as much as I do. When I kill, I kill for queen and country.
Okay.
However, I must admit that killing you will be a pleasure.